97.9 FM, WCHL, and chapelboro.com present The Art of Potential, an illuminating talk show dedicated to getting your community educated, hired, and inspired. The Art of Potential combines real-world knowledge and expertise aimed at helping our community reach their full potential. Now, The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Hi, this is Kristen Heemster. Welcome to the Art of Potential show. Oh, do we have a great show in store for you today. I am talking with Mia Burrows, and if you live in Chapel Hill, you have likely heard of Mia Burrows or seen her name on one of those signs running for school board or for county commissioner. So welcome, Mia.
I am so glad to be here with you. This is a gorgeous day outside, and we're going to have a great time.
Yes, we are. So I want to know, what got you interested in getting involved in local politics?
Well, so the thing is that my parents were really – actually, my father was very involved.
Okay.
For years and years and years. But actually, the pivotal thing is that one time I was complaining to my mother, as teenagers will do, and complaining about something, and I said, they have to do something about that. My mother just looked at me and she said, who are they?
Mm-hmm.
Are you they? Can you do something about it? And so it really – that stuck with me. That,
yes.
That there's always something – you any problem there is, you always have to look at it and go, is there something I can do to make it better? And so
– I am they.
I am they.
That would be a great logo. I am them. No, that is so true though. You know, it's not big government. It's like, you know, we are actually part of the government, you know.
Right.
I feel very much the same. So tell me about your dad was involved in local politics. Where was he involved?
So I grew up outside of Philadelphia.
Okay.
And in fact, what it was is he was a peace activist during the Vietnam War.
Okay.
He is was a Quaker and was just really, upset about the war.
Yes.
In contrast, and interestingly, he was a World War II veteran, but
– that is a very interesting contrast. So he had actually done service.
He'd done service.
And he had fought.
He hadn't fought, but he had shipped out and trained. And then when it came around to the Vietnam War, he just felt like that was the wrong war. And so he got very, very involved in protests, and even he was thrown in jail twice. Something that I thought of this summer as folks were getting arrested in Raleigh.
Yeah. my people.
Exactly. But I get that. I get what they're doing. Actually, there's a classic family story where I was just a little girl, and it was Monday, and his office called. I don't really know why I was home. Pick up the phone. It's his office. They say, so where is Miles, my father's name? And I say, oh, he's in jail.
Yeah, I know. Because as a kid, that's the answer.
That was the answer, and it was normal.
Yeah.
But in fact, he just continued involved. And then he actually got more involved in local things. He always felt like he had to make a difference. So he was doing later a local version of Habitat for Humanity, and he just always was finding ways to help.
Do you think that was part of his Quaker upbringing, kind of the philosophy of the Quakers? Do you think it was him or a mixture of both that just kind of brought out who he was?
Combination of those things. I think he just – I think for him, meaning was about doing for others, not so much individuals. He wasn't like a big social guy, but just trying to make a difference in the world. And then being a Quaker, their philosophy is very generally, anti-war. And so it just – those two things fit together, and he just got increasingly involved.
So was your upbringing Quaker then in the Friends community?
Moderately so.
Okay.
Interestingly, I come from two different backgrounds. My mother is Jewish and my father is Quaker, and I am something in between. And so but I think in both cases, I think both those traditions have a real emphasis on service. So
yeah.
I think that's where
absolutely
it comes from.
I just love that because my father's a Presbyterian minister. So I'm always interested to see how people's upbringing in the context of their religion, their faith, their church, you can be Presbyterian on one side or another side and have radically different experiences. You know what I mean?
So no kidding.
It's always very interesting to me how that is infused into the – so did you go through the traditional bat mitzvah and all that kind
of – No.
Okay.
No.
So
– No. We were not really active on either side, but the values.
But the
were
values
there.
Were there, and really they were lived out. So right. You were living the faith, not necessarily having ceremonies around
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Exactly. And both those traditions really, really emphasize the importance of education.
Yes, they do.
So,
which brings us to you right now.
Exactly.
So, talk to me about how you got on the school board, or you began your journey to get on the school board.
So when my daughters started in school here, surprisingly long time ago, probably about 16 years ago now, amazingly, I felt that, and I feel this in general, that whatever you're involved in, you should contribute something. And mm-hmm. I also wanted my daughters to know that I thought that school was important. So I would volunteer. And at that point, I had a pretty flexible schedule, so I was able to volunteer in the classroom. So I started out as a classroom volunteer, and then there was an issue when my younger daughter was in second grade about staff getting cut, which is interestingly timely. And I got really involved. And part of it was about that I felt that, you know, that the staff needed all the support they could get.
Right.
And that additional staff cuts were actually going to make their jobs more challenging. So then when I got involved in a district-wide issue, I started to learn how the process works. I learned how the school board worked. And one thing led to another, and I ran for school board a few years later.
And here you are now.
Exactly.
Wow. And how long have you been on school board?
So I was elected 6.5 years ago.
Wow.
Yep.
So I want to know about when you ran for the first time. What were your feelings? How did you know how to do a campaign? I want to know about that process.
So the first thing is that I kind of had to be talked into it,
okay.
Which is very typically typical of women. Women,
right.
There's a story that I've heard this several times that women need to be asked 3 times to run for office before they'll do it.
Right.
Whereas men will just do it.
Right.
So and I fit that mold. A couple of people asked me to do it, and it was very unnerving. It you're really putting yourself out there publicly.
You totally are, yeah.
And so that was unfamiliar. I had early in my professional life worked on a U.S. Senate campaign,
okay,
up in Pennsylvania. So although that was on a much bigger scale, a massively bigger scale than a school board race, the concepts are similar.
Yeah,
it's communicating with folks both individually and at events, and having a message and doing some advertising and getting, you know, finding supporters. And so all those concepts kind of came back to me as I was doing it. The other thing is that I relied on folks who'd run this process before.
Okay. So you're getting advice from people around you.
Absolutely. Exactly. I had coffee with a number of people who were elected officials at the time and just picked their brain and said, okay, what do I do? Where do I buy the signs? Where do
Those are legitimate questions, and I wonder that because everyone – there's got to be some big sign manufacturer out there that's doing, you know, campaign signs for everybody.
Right. There are. Well, and there are many of them, but how would you know? And,
right.
And exactly. And where would you look? And what, you know, what's legitimate? And they're funny things. There's lots of funny campaign lore, especially around here. People love to talk about signs and what kinds of signs are the best signs.
Right. Well, and then I've heard people's signs get stolen sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it's like, really?
They really do. They get stolen. They get moved around.
I did see one get repurposed. It went from it's like, you know, buy a 4-bedroom house for $100 or something.
But my husband loves sign wrangling. For some reason, he loved it. He would move them around to put them in the optimal place, and then he would change his mind. So that's the other thing. You have to get volunteers.
I was going to say, it's good to have a nice partner working with you, making
right.
sure your signs are visible to everybody.
Right, right. No, when I started to run, I thought, okay, this is my thing. I'm not going to drag my family into it. But somewhere little by little, he just got more and more interested about this one aspect of it. But then I asked other people, you know, for volunteers, you know, friends of mine who are encouraging me. I just, you know, I said, oh, okay. You can help write a letter to the editor or things like that.
All right. Well, we are going to take a break. And when we come back, we are going to learn more from Mia Burrows about some of the issues that are facing our community today. You are listening to The Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra. Please take a moment to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra with The Art of Potential Show, and I am talking with Mia Burrows. So, Mia, right now you're on school board, all kinds of talk about the budget.
Yes, and that is the appropriate tone of voice to use when discussing
There's always
the
been
budget.
Talk about the budget, but right now it's like down two octaves and...
Exactly. Oh, yes. We've been, I was elected 6 years ago and had one honeymoon year where we weren't cutting or trying to, you know, thinking about what we were going to cut. And now, the last 5 years, each year, we've had to look at cuts and keep thinking about what can we change that will have the least impact on students. And so we've actually, in terms of our local money, we've cut $8 million over 5 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Yep.
I work in education. Let me just make that clear. So I feel this pain maybe more so than other listeners might. But
absolutely. There's many, many things. It's not only what we've cut, but it's also what we can't do.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, you know, particularly with our state funding, had there not been a Great Recession, things not changed, we would have somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 more staff people across the district. And I know, mm-hmm. I certainly know you know, mm-hmm. how stressed teachers are and right. staff are and just trying to do so many things. And I think, boy, if we hadn't, you know, had additional staff spread across the district able to pitch in, there'd be a lot more, you know, that folks could do.
There really are. And I think you bring up a really good point that I'm not sure that people even who have kids in the school system realize, because I didn't realize until I was working for the school system. And it's changed now from when I started. But the amount of things you're pulled to do is crazy, whether it is, you know, everyone has to develop their own professional plan. Okay, well, that's normal. But then you have to also adhere to these other guidelines that are coming off for this, and then you have to do this, respond to this. So you spend, you know, each month you get hit with some other thing, whether it's at a state level, a federal level, or a local level that you're responding to, and you're supposed to teach and develop your curriculum and keep your students engaged, and then you've got all these different learning levels in your classroom, and that's supposed to be your full-time job, but yet it's fascinating to me. In a negative way, honestly, but it's still fascinating how many layers are on top of teaching. It's not teaching. It's like, you know, kind of like trying to keep your limbs intact.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think you hit on one of the reasons for it is everybody cares about education and every level of government. And this is even more so in North Carolina than some other places. Every level of government has their fingers in it. So we're structured. In other states, the state is not nearly as involved in education.
They weren't in Virginia in the same way, in mm-hmm. a different way, but not in the same way.
Right. And so we you know, the district has priorities and things that, you know, that we care about and our citizens care about, because that's right. what, you know, informs
and we like
the
our
board.
Citizens.
And
yeah.
we like our citizens. And that informs, you know, the board's thinking about things, but then we have you know, directives from the state, and not only there's not just one voice directing things from the state. No. There's multiple voices. There's the Department of Public Instruction, there's the State Board, there's the General Assembly, and there's the governor. All of whom have ways of making directives that come down to the schools, and so we often have directives that conflict. So on that in particular, I feel for our teachers. The other thing that we have, which can be a good thing, but I just think is stressful for folks, is technology is changing.
Yeah, rapidly.
And in fact, then the new technologies are likely to be better, but the transitions are tough.
Right.
So if you roll out something that's statewide, right. All of a sudden—
It's outdated by the time it gets into the classroom. I'm sorry, did I say that out
you
loud?
You did say that out loud.
If it's a statewide thing, though, it really is.
Yes, I mean that happens, and then also it can be very buggy, and there isn't, and you feel this total lack of control because you're working in a school trying to get things done, and it's somebody at the state that has to fix it. So there's a lot. So I have so much respect for our teachers and our staff because, in spite of all that, I see these instances of faculty remaining really passionate about what they do. Mm-hmm. and doing, you know, really going the extra mile for students. And so I sometimes I wonder how do they do it. And that's not even
sometimes
to mention.
We wonder too. But yeah, no. And one other thing I'd like to say, though, to your point, DPI, the Department of Public Instruction, has been completely gutted, and I don't think people realize that. So at this position I'm in, which is a school counselor, we will be given directives and then they'll gut the department it came from. And so trying to get things out and respond to the person who sent the directive, who's no longer there, but somebody else is now in charge, it's been very interesting because, you know, all of education has been gutted. It hasn't just been,
right,
you know. And we've been lucky in Chapel Hill because of our citizens. I mean, we have felt it, but to the degree that other places have, I'm not sure.
So I think that's an excellent point, that one of the things that's happening right now in our district is that we're looking at cuts that probably will impact students and classrooms more than we have in these 5 years.
Yeah.
We found so many different ways, you know, try to rearrange things, and yeah. and frequently would have, you know, impacted staff. You know, the middle school teachers teach an extra section before, so that certainly had an impact on their days. But the students wouldn't feel it. And so 5 years into the Great Recession, we've been able to protect because of the support from our county and our county commissioners. And to some extent also,
absolutely,
we did receive some federal dollars that would allowed us to spread or to prevent the pain for a while.
Right.
The calculus we did not make is that the recession would finally start to lift and then our General Assembly would not be providing additional dollars.
Right.
And so we really felt like if we held on,
yeah. And you all used your resources to do that. I know the county was floating, you know, money at points, you know, going into their savings, saying, "Oh, we can Band-Aid this for a few years."
Right, we can make it. We can make it. And then, unfortunately,
we did make it.
And now, so it's very hard to explain, you know, especially folks. You know, at the elementary level, who may not have lived here 5 years ago, or whose children were infants at the time, weren't being paid attention, they wouldn't have seen this sort of 5-year progression of what we've tried to do. And you know, all indicators are we're finally doing better economically, and all of a sudden our district's going, oh no, we actually have to cut staff. The one thing I will say is this is the worst, I think. We're cutting positions. Our board meets tonight to talk about this.
How timely
this is incredibly this? Incredibly timely. And in fact, I think the discussions will continue beyond tonight. So the final decisions may not be even made then. But the point being, you know, even the changes we're thinking about that the superintendent's recommending now would be cutting positions, but that the staff would probably be able to get other positions within the district because
that's
we're
nice.
Big. We have over 2,000 employees, so we do have attrition. And so at least it's not the very worst of laying folks off completely off the district's role. So that's the silver lining, certainly, especially for individuals who are affected. But it's a very confusing scenario for the community and very frustrating, and it's getting a little old, I would say.
And I'll just tell this quick story. And you were on the school board at this time. I was actually laid off back, 2008 maybe. And Neil Peterson was the superintendent at that time, and he was absolutely wonderful to me. You know, and he and the school board worked really hard to find money to bring the position. It wasn't a personal thing. It was more like, you know, we're just not staffing at this level anymore. And I was very lucky because I was laid off, I think, for a few months. And then I was told, okay, we found the money. So I know you all have been working really hard. And I will say from an employee's perspective, that was such – it was like a big hug to know that the superintendent and the school board were all working to try to help you keep your job and do that. So I really want to make that public how much I appreciate that. We are going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to hear more from Mia about not just what's going on with the schools, but also with the county and county commissioner business. You are listening to The Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra. Please take a moment to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back to The Art of Potential. This is Kristen Heemstra, and I am talking with Mia Burrows. So, Mia, getting back to some of the things the school board is facing, I want to know from you, just in general, what have been some surprises for you on the school board? What have been some delights for you as you have sat on the board? What did you expect? What didn't you? Like, tell me all about it.
So being on the board, you know, some of it is you can see because the school board meetings are televised and you can and folks can see it. But probably actually the most delightful thing, and in fact, the person I first explained this to was the former principal of East Chapel Hill High School, Dave Thade, and I'd been on the board about 6 months, and he says to me, "So you still like it?"
Yeah, Dave Thade.
I said, "Why, yes, I do. I actually do. And what I like about it is the people." Mm-hmm. I think folks who go into education are just generally a really amazing group of people. And we have very incredibly competent and skilled folks in our district. And the two superintendents that I've worked with, Neil Peterson and Tom Versella, have just been, you know, really very different leaders, but very, very strong leaders. So to me, actually, it wasn't something I thought about, and I really like my colleagues, the other board members.
That is great, because in some ways, do you ever feel like you're like in the trenches because we're fired at all the time?
Well, that happens, and also we just spend a lot of time together. You know, many weeks we're together doing
very like each other. Yes.
Yeah, it is good to know. And you know, one of the things is that I really appreciate about our school board, and not all elected bodies are like this, but our school board, we really respect each other, and we respect. Mm-hmm. We know that we're not going to agree,
right?
At times,
and that's okay,
right?
No one's going to like be angry because you aren't in agreement. It's not personal. It's just
exactly. Yeah. It's not. It's not personal, and we listen to each other. I mean, there have definitely been times where you know a topic has come up, and a board member has said something, and I went, I hadn't thought about it that way,
right?
And I think that's one of the beauties of local politics, actually, as opposed to higher level, seriously partisan politics, is that our problems don't always fit in partisan boxes.
No, they don't.
They don't.
Even at the national level, they really don't.
They shouldn't, but that's how it plays out. And so, you know, the solutions require more, I think, more creativity in a way, and aren't, you know, they give you an opportunity for some really interesting problem solving. And when you're a member of a board or commission, you're one of, in this case, in my case, seven people. And so it's figuring out how you can work together to get to consensus. And so that's one of the things that I've actually really turned out that I enjoy doing is trying to figure out where is the consensus? How can we move forward? How can we not get stuck and not make decisions? Our district, going back many decades, actually has had a history of looking for the perfect solution and not actually moving forward. and so
looking for the pie in the sky.
Right. Well, you know, we have an intellectual community.
We've got enough brain power here. We can make this happen.
We can make this perfect. And in fact, in policy, it's the problems that come to elected boards generally don't involve perfection. The solutions, something's imperfect. And so then it's about coming to consensus about what are the principles involved here and what's most important in this situation, and trying to figure that out. And it's been really interesting. And I've really appreciated the folks I've worked with over these years to figure those things out.
So let's say that a parent has some issue. Do you get random, kind of angry emails? I don't know who to talk to, so I'm going to blast everybody. I'm curious how the parents are approached. Do parents approach you, first of all? I would assume that they did because we're a small community, and I can only imagine if you're out in the community, you're going to get approached. So that would be one question. And the other is, what is the best way for them to do it?
I love that question.
Yeah.
So both. We hear mostly from people by email.
Okay.
Every now and then by telephone, but it's pretty rare.
Yeah.
And then definitely the grocery store.
Yeah.
which I'm okay with. People often say, oh, I'm sorry I'm interrupting you because you're, you know, in your private time. I'm like, no, I'm on the school board for a reason. I like these issues. I want to hear what you have to say. And, you know, and so it's okay. And I'll let people know if I'm in a massive hurry. But those are the ways. And people, the advice I give to folks is don't come to, you know, to whoever you're going to approach, don't come with both guns pointed at them.
Mm-hmm.
Come with an attitude of how can we solve this together? And we have, I've been approached both ways.
Yes.
The guns are smoking.
Yes.
And then, you know, people with a much more problem solving kind of attitude. And it may be that the angry folks have a point. And so as an elected official, your mission is to try to separate their point from the presentation.
From them.
From them.
But, let's separate the point from your presentation because your point is actually good.
But I really don't want to hear you.
Right. So, right now I don't like you, so it's hard for me to hear that your point is good. I'm just saying.
Bingo. So, I mean, that's what I really encourage folks. And then the other thing is the school board members have to do. And sometimes this takes a little training to get us, the board members, to remember to do this appropriately, is to talk to folks about the appropriate way to handle an issue. It, you know, people aren't shy here and they may come to a board member first when, in fact, what they really need to talk to is their child's teacher child's principal. You know, and so we talk to people about sort of the chain of how you solve a problem. Yeah. And then I usually end it by saying, and, you know, if you're still frustrated or whatever, you know, let me know. But if they do come back to let me know, it's generally for me to help direct them to the next appropriate person, and just so that they don't feel, you know. But that's actually quite rare.
I'm glad to hear that.
Not often does someone come back to me and say, no, I'm still really angry. And my guns are still pointed.
No, and I'd like to piggyback on that because as a school counselor, I see – what you know, we also get some of that. And to anybody listening who has an issue with the teacher, they do happen. We're people. That's normal for stuff to come up. Go to the teacher first. Please, please, please do not let the teacher know you're having an issue and give them the opportunity to address whatever the issue is. If you do not get a satisfactory response, absolutely go higher on the food chain. But please start, and it can be school counselors too, whoever the staff member is that you're having an issue with, let that person know so they have the opportunity to make it right. Because I do see that even in my job, people will call me very frustrated about a teacher, and they'll say, well, have you talked to them? No. Okay, well, we can't take this any higher, and that's one of the rules of administration. You can't go, you know, to a higher level until you've addressed it with the person.
Which is sort of a rule of life.
It is.
And, you know, people hate what they feel is confrontation.
Right.
So the two things are try to think of a way to approach it that's not as confrontational.
Right.
And B, just take a deep breath and do it anyway because it's generally on behalf of your kids. And usually everybody in the room cares about kids. And that's what people just need to remember it and remember that and just to try to deal with it. And boy, you know, I'm one of those people who doesn't like confrontation. Oddly, as a politician, I do not like confrontation.
You're in the wrong field, but I don't want to be the one to have to tell you that.
I don't know how this
all
happened.
Your quickness is showing through, right?
But sometimes you have to deal with it.
You do. And a decision needs to be made and all that
kind
of stuff.
And it's the right thing for your kids. So
the other thing I would say, just from my experience of being a school counselor for over a decade, is be prepared that you might not have the whole story. I will say that, shockingly, teenagers and young people sometimes only give you their version, and it's not always vetted for all the information or what actually transpired. It just might be tainted just a little bit. That's all I'm saying. Please make sure you get both sides, and then you can point the guns and get blazing hot or whatever it is that you need to do. But just be real aware that sometimes not all the information is laid out on the table.
And a variation on that point, which is, I think, one of the hardest things, actually, I bet for staff as well as school board members, is that I think appropriately, if something happened and involves another student, we can't talk about what happened with the other student or what the consequences were or any of those kinds of things, because the student has a federal right to privacy.
Well, that's a great way to end this segment. We'll go ahead. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Mia about advice she would give to her younger self as she's beginning this process and about her next stage, which is very exciting. You're listening to The Art of Potential Show with Kristen Hiemstra. Please take a moment, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Hiemstra, and I am talking with Mia Burrows, and we are talking about school board, county commission, all kinds of great stuff. So, Mia, my question to you, what is your next – you're on school board, but I think you've got some big plans out there. What is your next generation looking like?
Well, I am running for Orange County Commission for the District 1 seat. And the that seat covers Carrboro and Chapel Hill. Pretty much fits if you're in the Chapel Hill Carrboro School District, you're most likely in District 1.
Okay.
Pretty, they're around the edges, it's a little bit different. But anyway, so, and these are my people.
We love you, Mia. Yes. We're your people. We're your tribe.
I love Chapel Hill and Carrboro. I moved here almost 19 years ago. And you couldn't get me out for anything.
Right.
I love this community, and so
it is a great community.
Exactly.
So that certainly
helps when you're actually people who are interested in public service. It helps to have been in a community for a while and to really observe what's going on and read the paper and talk to folks, because I think sometimes folks will come to a new community or just not have been paying attention to the what goes on in the public realm, and then they just want to get involved. And there's a lot of backstory and a lot of context, especially in a place like Chapel Hill. We've been around for a while.
We also have a lot of colorful characters who, you know, also make our story always full of life and excitement.
And we are very opinion rich.
We are very opinionated. It's a nice way of saying what, yes. Opinionated group of folks.
Exactly. So anyway, that's help that I've been here for a while. But yes, yeah. I'm running for county commission. I'm very excited about that. I do not have a primary challenger, so I won't be on the ballot in May. I need to let my loyal supporters know that, so they won't be outraged.
Your name isn't on there.
What's wrong? Why are you out there? But I do have a challenger in the fall, so I'll be running a campaign, and the signs will be up in October, and I'll be doing all the events and those kinds of things. So
tell me about the events. How do you book yourself at an event? I mean, do you just announce you're coming and the people flock, or do you find a group of people and insert yourself in there? How does that work?
It comes in two directions. So during campaigns, there are organizations like the Sierra Club and the Orange County Democratic Women, and sometimes the schools, sometimes the League of Women Voters who have forums.
Yes,
and they invite you. The newspapers will often ask you to do to do surveys and to come for interviews and those kinds of things. So that just comes at you.
Yep.
And then when you're campaigning, then another thing that you can ask your friends and volunteers to do, and some of them will do it, is to throw a coffee and invite their friends. Particularly in my school board races, I did that several times, and that's fun because then it's a smaller group and they can ask you questions, and also it helps you kind of hone your message because you're hearing what people are thinking about, and that the more you talk about it, the easier that gets as well. And I really think, in spite of the fact that I don't have a primary challenger, is that campaigning is really important because you do hear from people and you learn things.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn about issues. I'm learning all kinds of new things. The county manages – they give half their budget – just under half their budget goes to the schools.
Which is amazing. That is a lot of money.
It's
a lot of percentage. It's not necessarily a lot of it, but it's a big percentage.
It's a very big percentage. And that's just what Orange County values are about, we really value education. Another big chunk of money goes to human services, which you can interview me another time. I'll talk about human services, but that's actually where my professional background is.
Mm-hmm.
And then things like public safety, libraries, and then trash and affordable housing. These are other issues. And so any given candidate will probably know a lot about a couple of those things. So part of the thing that happens in a campaign is that you get the opportunity to really start to learn about new issues. And for me, that's great. I find I am, in fact, I'm announcing it right here, I am a nerd.
Shocking news. Stop the presses.
I love this. I find even some of the most mundane issues I find interesting in terms of trying to figure out the choices and the solutions. So
it's exciting. I was on the 2020 program, the Chapel Hill 2020 Vision team, and I was on the environmental committee. I'm not sure that's what it was technically called. They have all special names. But it was just fascinating to hear, you know, the opinionated, very passionate people about what direction the community should go in. And then on the other hand, you had equally passionate and opinionated people, and they both wanted their agenda in. And what was interesting about that plan that was so skillfully, wonderfully done is that both of them are represented, and they're not merged necessarily. They're standalone. So there are actually, and I think the school board probably has this, things that are actually in conflict, but, you know, moving forward, they're represented. So your voice does get heard.
Right. Well, and I think you make a really interesting point about people needing to feel heard and being heard. And that's been one of the things that I have learned as being an elected official. If you come to speak to me or send me an email, you're definitely heard.
Right.
I may not agree with you.
Right.
Sometimes people get frustrated and they'll say, I didn't get heard. No, you just didn't get agree with.
Right.
But at the same time, you're absolutely right. We occasionally, the school board will get questioned, why do you have these things that appear to be somewhat conflicting? Well, maybe you learned this in school. I'm sure you do, actually, in civics class in high school. But policy making is akin to sausage making.
Right.
You don't want to see it made. And it's not tidy. You know, democracy is a messy business, and things change over time and all those. And then there are, you're trying to balance interests. And so all those things mean that you develop policies and programs that you feel at that time are the best thing to do for your citizens.
Time, right.
And then as time goes on, sometimes you as an individual elected official or the community will shift. And I think I see this community has even in the time I've been here has been shifting on some things, particularly like economic development.
Yeah.
And that's healthy. Times change and the kinds of jobs people do, all that kind of stuff is changing. So you always have to be relooking.
Yeah, kind of reinventing yourself as you go along. All right, last question to you. What advice would you give your younger self about this?
Be brave.
Okay. Be brave.
Don't, you know, I just think one of the fabulous things about being a woman of a certain age at this point. I'm a woman of a certain age. My mid-50s, I'll just be honest. I don't really care about age. Is just not fearing putting yourself out, not being afraid of making a fool of yourself, you know, not being afraid of those kinds of things, because odds are, A, you're not going to do those things, and B, even if you do, that's okay, because you learn and grow from it, and then you can laugh about it for the next 20 years.
But you see other people doing it, too, and you realize no one's perfect. And you're like, wait a minute. I don't know what it is in our younger years that makes it, or at least me. I thought, everybody has the perfect answer all the time. They don't.
They don't. You just – right, exactly. You just have to go and get out there and do it.
Get in. Be confident. That may be some of it. But anyway, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So, no, I encourage folks to do it. And the best thing to do is to watch, too. If there's something you think you might want to do, study the people who are doing it. See what they do. Talk to them and learn. I have a much – not a younger self. It was a very independently different self. But my oldest daughter's job hunting for the first time. And you just have to, you know, go out and talk to people and ask them how they got where they're going. And you just – that's the process. And it works not only – as I've told her, and I truly believe this, that kind of process not only is good for job hunting, it's good for life. Those are skills that you take into everything you do. So
absolutely. Great advice. Mia, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So you can download Mia's interview on the Art of Potential website. You can download it on Chapelboro as well. Thank you for listening. You have just listened to the Art of Potential show with Kristen Heemstra. Please take a moment, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter.